Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin, federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Compared to a few years ago, it seems like a miracle. Congress has funded the Coast Guard's largest acquisition budget ever. As Commandant Paul Zukoff put it in a recent State of the Coast Guard, the barometer is rising and the storms have abated. Admiral Zukoff joins me now with more. Admiral, great to have you back.
Tom, great to be back. Thank you.
All right, so let's talk initially about one of the things you mentioned early in this report, and that is shipbuilding. Talk about the plans and status right now for 2016 and beyond.
A couple of key milestones this current year. We have final design funding awarded to down-select the offshore patrol cutter. This will actually be the largest acquisition in Coast Guard history, dating back to our inception in 1790, 25 ships, with an emphasis on affordability. We have three contractors that are vying for this award, and we will down-select that award this fiscal year. What the surprise in this appropriation was it also provided funding for a ninth national security cutter, which is one above our program of record. But this was added to our top line. In years past, we've had to find sources of funding within our base, but instead this was an adjustment, which in actuality it doubled our acquisition budget. And so a very promising year for the Coast Guard as we continue to build out our fast response cutter, a fleet of 58 patrol boats. So it really puts the Coast Guard in a great position as we sail into the 21st century.
So the 25 are pursuant to an eventual new fleet of 58?
The 25 is the offshore patrol cutter. This is, I would call it a light frigate. And then, so we have, original program of record was 8 national security cutters. We now have funding for a ninth. 25 offshore patrol cutters, which we will award this year. And then the third major ship acquisition is the fast response cutter, 154-foot patrol boat, of which we will build 58 of those.
So this really is almost a total recapitalization of the afloat resources of the Coast Guard.
And it is, Tom, and it could not come at a better time. We have ships out there today that are 50 years old. We just decommissioned one yesterday after their 48th year of service, including service during the Vietnam conflict. So, yeah, we are running one of the oldest fleets of any of the navies in the world, and we're one of the larger navies in the world at that.
I guess except for the U.S. Navy, the Coast Guard alone would match most nations, probably as big as, say, Great Britain.
Believe it or not, Tom, our Coast Guard is bigger than Her Majesty's Navy.
All right. Well, it's a good thing it's going to be a newer one then, anyhow. And I wanted to ask you about some GAO reports that have cited problems with the National Security Cutter, that major components have been failing, and there's a 57-millimeter gun, a single-point davit that makes the lifeboats or the wobble, engine problems. What are you doing to address that whole issue?
All of these did not come as a surprise to us. We've identified many of these issues, and with the first two ships within our National Security Cutter fleet, we recognized that there were structural design oversights that we're going to have to go back and readdress. So, yes, we are attending to those, but at the same time, the ships are just performing remarkable. They have a unique ability to extract intelligence while they're deployed, which means when these ships go out and do a counter-drug mission, that they're not like a cop on the beat, you know, waiting for something to happen. They are going after known threats. Two of our national security cutters that came off a counter-drug patrol last year, on one patrol alone, removed enough cocaine, you know, at wholesale value that was worth more than the initial acquisition cost of those cutters. One removed 32 tons, another came back with 22 tons. I've got another one out there right now that's already starting to tally up similar numbers on their current patrol. So these are really game changers for the most relevant threats, maritime, to the homeland of the United States.
And what you say about them implies that there is some intelligence-gathering apparatus other than a different kind of weapon aboard, an electronic type of sensor type of pod maybe, or capability built into these ships.
Well, there is, and I probably can't go into any detail on that, but it's really changed the paradigm of how we deploy these days. Our older ships really go out blind, and as a former ship captain, you know, if you remember the movie Forrest Gump, and Lieutenant Dan says, yeah, the shrimp, they're right here, and they weren't. Well, it wasn't a whole lot different when we were out there doing counter-drug patrols 15, 20 years ago. We'd say, well, you know, the bad guys are going to be here, and they weren't, and you'd spend 3-4 months out there and not see a thing. Well, that has since changed. And now we know where they're at. We use our very broad authorities where we can board these vessels and use up to deadly force, including in the territorial seas of foreign nations. So very unique authorities that the Coast Guard has, U.S. Coast Guard, no other entity in the world has the broad authorities that we have in terms of going after illicit trafficking.
We're speaking with Admiral Paul Zukunft. He is Commandant of the Coast Guard. And just another question about the guns, pursuant to what you just said. 57-millimeter gun, that's a pretty good size caliber piece to have on top of a cutter.
It is, and it's Navy type, Navy owned. So when we look at our acquisition programs, rather than have a unique design separate to the Coast Guard, we look at commonality, especially with the United States Navy, because we also have a requirement in any contingency for these ships to be interoperable with the Navy fleet. So a lot of our command and control systems, our weapon systems, are what we call Navy type, Navy owned, and compatible with the United States Navy.
And just actually, I did have one more question about the ships. As you get the new ones into the fleet, these new national security cutters and later the offshore patrol cutters, since they are brand new and the other ones are quite old, are there crew quarter enhancements and quality of life enhancements on these that might surprise some of the people that have been around the Coast Guard a while?
Well, I remember back to my first ship back in 1977, in one of the berthing areas accommodated 40 people, you know, with bunks stacked three high and very cramped quarters, which made it very difficult, you know, prolonged deployment. On these new ships, the largest berthing compartment is six people to a berthing cabin, and many of these are 2- and 4-person staterooms. So the quality of life is significant. And there's also smaller crews. And so you've got a larger ship with actually fewer people. The National Security Cutter is 418 feet in length. It carries a crew of 126. The ship it replaces was 378 feet in length, but has a crew of 170. And so fewer people, obviously, it puts a lot more demand on these smaller crews, larger ship, and doing much more than that crew of 170 did with intelligence and all the other systems that we operate on these newer platforms.
And let's switch gears a minute. I wanted to ask you about something that you also mentioned in the State of the Coast Guard speech, and that is the interaction that the Coast Guard has with the intelligence community related to drug interdiction. Tell us more about how that works.
Yeah, so we've been a member of the national intelligence community ever since 9/11. And it's not just domestic, but obviously we look at, you know, global threats. And so we are plugged in where we use national intelligence-derived information, but we push it down to the most tactical level to pre-position our ships, our airplanes, our people to where those potential threats are. You're never going to know with absolute certainty, but you know with great potential. And so if I go back to 9/12, the day after 9/11, we had an armada of boats, you know, with the expectation that there might be a terrorist behind every piling in our maritime transportation system. We've matured that process so much so that, yes, we can't be at all places at all times, but we can look at where there are indications and warnings of where a threat may be. And it's not going to be perhaps in all 50 states, but if it's in a given region, we can move resources to address that potential threat.
And while we're on the subject of cooperation with other federal agencies, when it comes to the Southwest border infiltration, you work with Customs and Border Protection. Give us some more sense of how that operates.
Well, where it really begins for us, it begins in the transit zones. When contraband leaves South America, it typically is landed in Central America. It goes from bales down to, you know, gram size shipments that are then smuggled across the southwest border. But what happens when these drugs land is it becomes a safe haven for cartels. Huge money-making apparatus that brings with it corruption. It brings violent crime, and it's introduced violent crime to three of the areas, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, which, no coincidence, is where we're seeing the largest influx of illegal migration destined for the United States, to include unaccompanied minors. So downrange, we work very closely with Customs and Border Protection, who fly maritime patrol aircraft, helping us detect these threats that are out at sea. It's great if you have a lot of ships, but it also helps if you have eyes in the sky as well. As those threats come across the southwest border, that is really a Border Patrol-led effort there. But we've created, under the Department of Homeland Security, three task force, one led by a Coast Guard flag officer, another one led by CBP, and then another one led by ICE. The two led by one by Coast Guard is geographic, more maritime. The Border Patrol focuses on the southwest border. Investigations really looks at the information and trying to get inside the networks of primarily human trafficking and drug trafficking cartels.
And so it strikes me, hearing about this, the working with the other Homeland Security agencies, that really this is a good example of that unity of effort type of overarching initiative that the Secretary has been pushing for a couple of years now.
Yeah, and our Secretary, he has a lot of experience working inside the Pentagon and working among the other armed services who have the Goldwater-Nichols Act of 1986. No such animal exists within law enforcement or within the Department of Homeland Security. So, you know, this is truly is a unity of effort, but there is no Goldwater-Nichols mandate that would require us to do this. So it does bring these three cultures together and with a very relevant mission in support of the Department of Homeland Security's primary objectives.
And if you would, just give me a quick update on the semi-submersibles. Those have been a thorn in the side of the United States, both the Navy and the Coast Guard, for some time now. What's going on with those?
Well, this last year, in fact, 2 weeks ago, we seized another one with one of our national security cutters. We've seized four of these in the last 7 months. All of these were led, again, by intelligence, starting with where are these being built. Typically in triple canopy rainforest areas along the west coast of Colombia, but we've been able to get inside the information cycle of the movements of these assets, and then these semi-submersibles, that is, and then be able to pre-position our folks, our planes, cutters, to be able to interdict them. Otherwise, if we didn't have that advanced information, these are, in broad daylight, very, very difficult to detect.
All right, so while we're marching around the different parts of the globe for a moment, let's talk about the Arctic, which has become a tremendously important strategic area, climactic area, lots of nations up there. What's the Coast Guard doing in the Arctic?
Well, I'm very encouraged by the President's budget for 2017. That sets aside $147 million to acquire new heavy icebreakers for the United States. And these really are national assets, and they happen to say U.S. Coast Guard on the side of them, but it really is a national asset. We're seeing more and more activity in the high latitudes. There will be a cruise ship transiting the Northwest Passage this summer, carrying over 1,000 passengers on it, in an area where only 5% of it is chartered to modern-day standards. The fare to embark on this voyage for a passenger is approaches $20,000 per person, and it's sold out. So if this is the voyage of a lifetime, we expect there will be many more after this as well. But right now, our capacity to respond to a mass rescue scenario in those high latitudes very limited.
Well, at least it's not one of those gigantic Carnival cruise ships going up there.
This is the largest to make the transit to date. So again, 1,000 passengers, probably plus another 600 crew. Where in years past, we have two helicopters pre-positioned up in Barrow, Alaska, or up in the North Slope. And, you know, they could maybe, between the two of them, take maybe 16 people, but not 1,600.
Wow. So also, you've noted that China is operating in the Arctic. Now, there are several Arctic nations. I guess the most significant one besides the United States is Russia. But what about China? What have you seen there? What is their role, and why are they up there?
China has a medium icebreaker, and they certainly consider the Arctic as part of the global commons, and quite honestly, much of it is. But there again, the United States Coast Guard has done extensive sea mapping beyond our traditional continental shelf, and it's known as the extended continental shelf, outside of the traditional 200 miles. And what that means, it's an area about equivalent to the size of about the state of California, which would technically be sovereign waters of the United States when it comes to any mineral or natural resource exploitation within those waters. But we have seen other nations traditionally doing research in these very same waters. And so it concerns me, as we've seen China very vociferously claiming that if it's East China Sea or South China Sea, it's China's sovereign territories. They've built islands, and now they've militarized those as well. So the precedent that China has set in the East and South China Sea is of great concern, because this could very well be a corollary to that, as we see their interests in the Arctic, which have been less than transparent.
So lots of intelligence gathering, I imagine, with respect to China and Russia going on there, as well as just icebreaking operations.
Well, we're keeping an eye on it, but we only have one pair of eyes. We have one heavy and we have one medium icebreaker. Our heavy icebreaker, the Polar Star, is just making her way back home from her mission down in Antarctica, where the ability to break 21 feet of ice is an absolute requirement. The only platform in our nation's inventory that can break ice up to that thick. So she's traditionally committed to the Antarctic. Our medium icebreaker, the Healy, is traditionally committed to the Arctic. And so, obviously, we have very limited coverage of those two areas, but, you know, both of them are of great concern to me, the Arctic and the Antarctic.
So if Congress were to authorize the construction of new icebreakers, how long does it take from that appropriation to when they're actually deployed, design, build, test, and so forth?
Well, we're doing everything we can to accelerate the timeline. Yeah, we do not have the appropriation in hand yet. But we are already hiring the acquisition staff that would be required to build this out. We've socialized with five other entities that have Arctic equities, Arctic Research Council, National Science Foundation, Defense, Interior, Commerce, Homeland Security, Coast Guard, of what do you need a heavy icebreaker to do. So we've done all of the upfront homework, if you will, and then we've also transmitted through Fed Biz Ops, this is what we need a heavy icebreaker of the 21st century to do. And so that has gotten into the hands of industry. And so there are a number of shipyards here in the United States that said, we can do this. But we're also reaching out internationally to see what designs are on the table. And is there a commercial off-the-shelf design that could be built here in the United States? And the design work alone could take 2 years. If you're designing from the ground up. But if you're taking a parent craft design, that will probably trim at least 2 years off that timeline. So by the time you award a contract, you build it out, you take it through sea trials, into the heavy ice, and then say, okay, this will meet our missions, you're probably talking, you know, from today to end state, you know, a timeline of probably no less than 8 years.
We're speaking with Admiral Paul Zukunft, the Commandant of the Coast Guard. So that means that even with the appropriation cycle moving ahead on this, it would really, in reality, be a decade until the United States could get more ice-breaking capacity.
Nearly so, Tom. That's correct. And a concern of mine is, you know, we refurbished the Polar Star, our only heavy icebreaker in service right now, with the expectation that that would buy us about 10 years of service. We've consumed 3 of those 10 years already, and so that clock is running down. But we're also, we've done an assessment. It'll be fully completed by a third-party contract on our other heavy icebreaker that has been laid up now for over 5 years. That ship's name is the Polar Sea up in Seattle. The hull of the ship is in great condition, but the engineering plant, the auxiliary systems, that's a whole other story. So by the end of July, we will be able to have a determination whether it is worth the investment to try to reactivate this 40-year-old ship. How many years do we buy? But that's another option that's on the table as well. That may accelerate that timeline a little bit. But eventually, yes, we are going to need, you know, new icebreakers to replace this older fleet that we have today.
And I wanted to ask you about the arrangement the Coast Guard has. You've got people embedded with the UK Navy. What is the purpose there, and how does it all work?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great lesson learned for any service chief is, you know, if you ever encounter, you know, struggles in an annualized budget and you look at where do you make trade-offs, you know, sometimes you might look at, well, hey, let's just not bring new people in, and you could save money, and you do. And so the Royal Navy, a number of years ago, you know, came to one of those intersections, and they said, well, we will just stall accessions for a given period of time in order to fund our other priorities. Well, what's happened now 15 years later is those senior technicians, mostly machinists, operating in the fleet, don't exist. And so the Royal Navy came to the Coast Guard and said, you know, for the next several years, until we can grow this level of experience and leadership, would it be possible if we had Coast Guard senior petty officers, usually at the chief level, augment Her Majesty's Navy? And so we've done that. We have about 36 senior enlisted members who are now living in the United Kingdom with their families, all fully reimbursed by the United Kingdom, until the Royal Navy is able to close this gap. But it was all created going back to a budget-driven decision over 15 years ago.
I just wonder what some of the admirals of the old days would say from the Royal Navy if they knew this one.
Well, it's a good fit for both of us. It just so happens that many of the engineering plants that are in Her Majesty's fleet are compatible with the very same engineering plants that we have in the Coast Guard. And the folks that we send are some of our absolute best, and they're accustomed to doing maintenance on the fly, if you will, which means, you know, far removed from your home port, and there's no contractor, and you are the master technician, if you will, to do the troubleshooting and maintenance on any engineering casualty while you're deployed.
And finally, I wanted to ask you about your visit to Silicon Valley. Many military, many federal leaders have gone out there and seem to be transfixed with the place. What did you learn? How does it map to the human capital strategy that you have for the Coast Guard in the next few years?
Yeah, so that's a big concern for me, Tom, and it's not a concern today, but I go back to the Royal Navy. And this is going to be a challenge within the next decade. Today, if you look among our population of 17 to 24-year-olds in this country, fewer than 25% of them meet the minimal requirements to serve in an all-voluntary military service. So assuming we do not have a draft. So I'm vying, and I'm not even going after that 24th, 25th percentile. I'm going for that top 5% within that 25%. Well, no surprise, you know, so is Silicon Valley. And they could probably come up with a better compensation package than I can. And if they can't find that 17 to 24-year-old, then they'll look at that 35-year-old in a military uniform with the security clearance, with many of the attributes that they're seeking. And much like we've seen with the airline industry, will outbid me for their services. So it first comes back to, you know, how do we continue to recruit, train, but more importantly, how do you retain a workforce of the 21st century? The Coast Guard is unique in that you know, the center of gravity for our enlisted workforce is at the E6, E7 level, not as much at the junior levels where it might be in the case of, you know, maybe in the Army or Marine Corps. And so it's important that I have those folks, you know, serve more than one enlistment. And this comes at a point in time where blended retirement will arrive in 2018, where we don't know what this is going to have, impact it'll have on retention. If we contribute into a thrift savings plan, matching pay for our workforce, do they decide after 8-9 years, hey, I've got a nice little portfolio, thanks for the training, thanks for the marketing, you know, the marketable skill sets, time for me to leave. And so the retention side of this causes me some concern. And, oh, by the way, I've got to find the matching pay to put into this thrift savings plan as well. So it really does cause confusion, uncertainty. In hindsight, we had a pretty good way to forecast what our retention rates would be 20 years out. But with this blended retirement, it's going to be very difficult to make those longer range forecasts. And if you lose that mid-range petty officer, you're right back to where the Royal Navy is. You've got a hole in your organization, and you cannot surge experience and leadership to close those gaps.
Lots of challenges, lots of opportunities ahead. Admiral Paul Zukunft is Commandant of the Coast Guard. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks again, Tom. Great to hear from you.
Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends.